Luke 8:40 through 56. Now when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. Just then there came a man named Jairus, a leader of the synagogue. He fell at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter about 12 years old who was dying. As he went, the crowds pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years, and though she had spent all she had on physicians, no one could cure her. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his clothes, and immediately her hemorrhage stopped. Then Jesus asked, "Who touched me?" When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowds surround you and press in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I noticed that power had gone out from me." When the woman saw that she could not remain hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him. She declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." While he was still speaking, someone came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher any longer." When Jesus heard this, he replied, "Do not fear. Only believe, and she will be saved." When he came to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. They were all weeping and wailing for her, but he said, "Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But he took her by the hand and called out, "Child, get up." Her spirit returned, and she got up at once. Then he directed them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astounded, but he ordered them to tell no one what had happened. The word of the Lord.
I do love a good mise en ombre. Am I right? You know what I'm talking about? Mise en ombre? I mean, you know what I'm talking about. You get it right. Is that right? Am I saying that right? Mise en ombre? I'm sorry. My French pronunciation is terrible, but c'est la vie. In English, it's story within a story. That's what it is. Or the play within a play. It's the nested story. Like the murder of Gonzago in Hamlet. Or the Grand Inquisitor in Brothers Karamazov. Or the courtier's tragedy in Pynchon's The Crying of Lot 49. You know what I'm saying. No? Kurt Vonnegut's use of Kilgore Trout in Breakfast of Champions? How about the premise of that seminal Scott Bakula vehicle, Quantum Leap? Yeah, you know what I mean. Or, okay, itchy and scratchy. The story within a story. It's a literary device found anywhere there's a narrative tradition, which is, you know, everywhere. It's in ancient Indian tales, Jain folklore, Buddhist stories, Chinese and Hebrew scripture. It's when a second distinct narrative interrupts the main narrative, and at its conclusion, the main narrative continues. The inner story is used in several ways. Most often, it has a lot of similarities to the outer story, but might distill the point of the narrative or comment on the narrative. I found a description. I won't read it in the French, but it is... says this: the inner stories are told either simply to entertain or more usually to act as an example of the other to the other characters. In either case, the story often has symbolic or psychological significance for the characters in the outer story. There is often some parallel between the two stories, and the inner story is used to reveal the truth of the outer story. So first, let's take a look at our outer story here, or this interrupted narrative. Jesus and his disciples have just returned to Galilee, and there's a huge crowd there to meet him. And Jesus had been on a really big healing tear, so people were coming from all over the place. Just when he gets there and all these people are gathered around him, Jesus, this man approaches. It's Jairus. Jairus is one of the leaders of the synagogue. He's a very important man. And he falls at Jesus' feet, and he begs him, please, come to my house. Because his daughter, his only daughter, his 12-year-old daughter, is dying. And Jesus agrees to go with him, and the whole crowd is following, because they're thinking, here's another miracle. We're going to actually witness this miracle. And so they all go with him to see it. And there's so many people there, and they're pressed against him. And as Jesus and his disciples are making his way to Jairus' house to heal his daughter who's dying, someone from Jairus' house comes up to Jairus and says, your daughter's dead. Don't trouble the teacher anymore. Like, it's too late. There's nothing that can be done. But when Jesus hears this, he says to Jairus, do not fear. Don't be afraid. Only believe, and she will be saved. Have faith, and your daughter will be saved. So they continue on. They arrive at the house. The crowd is all excited to see the miracle, but Jesus won't let them come in. For some reason, this is not going to be a public miracle. Jesus goes into the house only with his closest disciples, Peter, James, and John, and the daughter's mother and father. And they are all of them. They're weeping and wailing. Weeping and wailing is not what you do when you have faith that Jesus is going to heal the child. Weeping and wailing is what you do when someone has died. Jairus, the leader of the synagogue, his wife, even Jesus' closest disciples, Peter, James, and John, are mourning the death of this 12-year-old girl. Presumably because they entered the house and they see her lying on her bed, dead. Even if on the way they might have tried to believe, clearly they were not able to muster enough faith, if faith is something one can muster. Obviously, they did not believe, and she was not saved. Sadly, they see her there. She's died. But Jesus says, don't cry. Don't cry. Don't weep. Don't wail. She's not dead. She's just sleeping. And just to underline their lack of faith, they all laugh at Jesus. They laugh. They're laughing at him because they know that she's dead. They know that she's dead. They didn't have any faith. They didn't have any belief. Clearly, they can see that she's dead. But Jesus reaches out and touches her, takes her by the hand, and says, child, get up, and her spirit returns. And she gets up at once, and Jesus says, give her something to eat. And her parents are astonished. She's saved, restored. She's returned to her family. So that's the outer narrative. The point seems to be, if you lack faith, if you can't believe, even if no one around you has any faith or any belief, God will still heal. God will still restore you. God will still take you by the hand and lift you up off your bed and sit you down at the supper table with your friends and family. That is radical mercy. Our salvation, our forgiveness, our restoration does not depend on anyone's faith or action. It is done for us from the outside. It's the mercy of God that leads to restoration. Now let's look at this internal narrative, or the interrupting story. Jesus is making his way to Jairus' house to heal the 12-year-old daughter. Moving with this great crowd, pressing in on him, trying to move along next to him, be next to him, when a woman who'd been suffering from a hemorrhage for 12 years she had been bleeding and had spent all her money, the text says, on physicians, and no one can cure her. And she comes up from behind Jesus and touches the fringe of his clothes. And immediately the bleeding stops. She touches him and she's healed. And Jesus notices. He says, "Who touched me?" And everyone's saying, "What do you mean? Nobody touched you." Peter says, "There's people all around you. How can you tell? There's somebody just..." And he said, "No, someone has touched me, and I felt the power go out." Well, the woman who'd been healed had hoped to sneak off and not be noticed, because she was scared, because she wasn't supposed to be there, because she wasn't supposed to touch anyone, because she was unclean. It would have been a sin for her even to let somebody in her house in her unclean state. So to be pushing through a crowd, making everyone she touched ritually unclean, and then to go purposefully and touch a rabbi was insane. It was courting condemnation. Leviticus 15 is a whole chapter on discharge. Male, female, all kinds of discharge. I don't recommend reading it. But it says, if a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her impurity, or if she has a discharge beyond the time of her impurity, all the days of that discharge she shall continue in uncleanliness, as in the days of her impurity. She shall be unclean, and every bed on which she lies during all the days of her discharge shall be treated as the bed of her impurity. And everything on which she sits shall be unclean, and everything that she touches shall be unclean, as in the uncleanliness of her impurity. So she realizes that she's not going to get away. She's not going to get away without being noticed. So she comes trembling and she falls down at Jesus' feet. And she admits in front of the crowd, in front of everyone, what she's done. She admits that she's been bleeding for 12 years, knowing that she is impure, knowing that when she is pushed through the crowd and even touched the fringes of Jesus' clothes, that she has caused everyone to be unclean. But then she also says that when she did touch Jesus, she was immediately healed. Immediately healed. The bleeding stopped. And instead of the rebuke and the condemnation that she was expecting, Jesus calls her daughter. And he says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." She is healed. She is saved. She is restored to the community, no longer required to keep her distance, to be untouchable. She's whole. So the internal narrative here, we have a woman with no one to act on her behalf, no one to go fetch the rabbi for her, no one to bring Jesus to heal her. So on her own, she risks condemnation because she has faith. She has faith that Jesus can heal her. And she acts on her beliefs and is healed. She makes it happen. She has the agency. She initiates her healing. She has no right to do what she does. She violates so many laws in doing it. And Jesus calls that faith. And that faith heals her. That is radical mercy. So here in our Maison Omri, I thought I'd try one more time. Our story within a story is in tension with the main narrative. The original hearers of this work would have been surprised, even offended by this juxtaposition. It's the leader of the synagogue who is supposed to have a great faith, not the unclean outcast woman. It is the father that's supposed to do anything to save his child, not laugh when someone says she can be saved. Jesus should be appalled when he realizes that he has been touched by this unclean woman. But instead, he calls the violation of that law an act of faith and breaks the ritual purity laws himself when he touches the dead girl. Numbers 11 says that it is forbidden to touch a dead body. Those who touch the dead body of any human shall be unclean. This narrative with its story within the story is often interpreted as a story that overturns the power structure, saying that no longer do the powerful leaders like Jairus have the moral authority. No longer do the leaders of the governing institutions, the temple and the synagogue, have the spiritual agency to administer forgiveness to the lowly sinners, to the impure, to restore the outcast to the community. But with this new way ushered in by Jesus, the most marginalized peoples are empowered to act to bring about their salvation. Even their transgressions committed on their quest for restoration are seen as acts of faith. To which I say, Dieu merci, or thank God in English. In the inner narrative, we see faith and action lead to forgiveness, salvation, restoration. And in the outer narrative, we see lack of faith and inaction lead to forgiveness, salvation, and restoration. This is radical mercy. Those who act in faith and those who laugh and mock at its possibility are all taken up in the same mercy of God.